We decided yesterday, I was going so fast on Rastafarianism, we decided to sort of stop where we were and Ian actually go through this a little bit more slowly. Mm-hmm. We have time. So why don't we start off with 151. Okay. This is we're still in the previous handout. And we'll kind of walk you through in a more detailed way the development of Rastafarianism in Jamaica. As I pointed out yesterday, it was on November the 2nd, 1930, that Rastafari Makonnen was crowned emperor, and he took on the name Haile Selassie, which means power of the Holy Trinity. And as I also pointed out yesterday, this was considered to be the fulfillment of a prophecy given by Marcus Garvey several years earlier. He was the leader of the Back to Africa movement in Jamaica. He was a forerunner to Martin Luther King Jr. So who was Martin Luther King Jr.'s inspiration? He always pointed back to Marcus Garvey. Yeah.
I have a question for you. Yesterday you mentioned that His Imperial Majesty, that these titles that were given to him, such as the Conquering Lion of the Tribe of Judah, Elect of God, King of Kings, Lord of Lords, that he saw that as a manifestation of God's glory. Do we have record of that? I mean, I feel like if somebody's calling you this and you're accepting being called this, mm-hmm. then there's kind of a
implicit claim on your part.
Yeah.
If it is, there are two ways to interpret it. It's either a claim on his part that he is these things, or it is a kind of symbolic gesture on his part that I hope that I'm being endowed with them, and to the degree that I represent them, I am them. Meaning them by them, meaning the power of the Trinity.
I guess I would have to say, is there some sense that even if it's not pure Rastafarianism, that in Jamaican culture or I guess also Ethiopian culture at the time, was he considered to be a god? Because, I mean, do they look at him now in some parts of Jamaica and consider him to be the emperor, to be the god?
Well, the reason I doubt a overly literalistic interpretation of the titles is precisely because of how he reacts when all these Jamaicans start worshiping him in Jamaica. A man who really thought that he was these things probably would not have reacted that way. Mm-hmm. Now, I'll give you, if we'll peel back the curtain a little bit, the Ethiopian Orthodox Church rejects the Chalcedonian formula. The Chalcedonian formula was a creedal formula drawn up in the wake of the Christological controversies that sort of spilled over in the wake of the Trinity. So when the doctrine of the Trinity was written up and settled, and it was settled in two stages in 325 AD with the Council of Nicaea, and then it was reaffirmed in 381 with the Nicene formula, where the deity of the Holy Spirit was added to that. With those stages, the church pretty much put parameters around what you could and couldn't say about the Trinity. And all branches of Christendom embraced the Nicene creed. But then in the wake of that, the question became, what is Christ? We say Jesus is God, but what does that mean when we talk about the fact that Jesus is man? And you had different theories floating around as to how to understand that. And so in the wake of those controversies, you had another council, the Council of Chalcedon, or Chalcedon, sometimes pronounced Chalcedon. And in the year 430, this creedal formula is written up that declared that Jesus is one person with two distinct natures. There were Christian groups that rejected Chalcedon. So while everyone accepts Nicaea, there are those who reject Chalcedon. And two of those were the Coptic Christians, and then, of course, the Ethiopian Orthodox Church. And they embrace what is called Monophysitism. Okay, the Monophysite view of Christ is that Jesus is one nature. So that in the incarnation, the divine and human intermingled. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now,
if that's true, then how can, if you say that's true, and human mingles with God, then that makes human partly God and God partly human. How's that
exactly? Mean? You've created a kind of third amorphous nature. Yeah. Now, that's the critique of it. In fact, you'll remember when we looked at Platonism, Van Til compared the Christ of Chalcedon with Plato's ideal man. And his criticism was that Plato's ideal man so intermingles temporal and eternal categories that you have this sort of colorless mass in the wake of that, and therefore in Platonism you have ultimate incoherence that obtains. So that in his grand attempt to be rational, Plato introduces total irrationalism into the system.
Right. I think it actually lessens the God image, at least. I don't know if it maybe amplifies the human, but to take one from either and combine it into some third, I don't think would overall be called an addition.
Right. And so if you agree with Van Til's critique of Plato, that critique of Plato applies almost exactly to the Monophysite Christology that was developed by those who rejected Chalcedon.
And the Coptic Christians, who are they?
They mainly hail in Egypt. And then, of course, the Ethiopians are down in Ethiopia, and their tradition just went in a different trajectory than others. Now, does that mean I know some people who will say, well, they are not Christians then. I, of course, am one of those who will not say you're not a Christian just because you reject the Chalcedonian formula. I'd have more concerns if you said, I reject Nicaea, right? That's the more, and they do accept Nicaea. They can't accept Chalcedon. And they do want to say that Jesus is both human and divine. They just have a formula for it that intermixes all that more than I'm comfortable with.
Yeah.
And I also find it to be incoherent like you do. But those are different issues than whether they really are, Christians. Now, I will say that one of the biggest problems with the Monophysite Christology is that if left unchecked, you might be prone to embracing a kind of pantheistic view of God, because if God has elevated human nature into the divine, literally, then we are God. Mm-hmm. The human nature is divine. And they would actually focus, the Greek Orthodox Christians, and now I'm broadening this from just Coptic and Ethiopic to just Eastern Orthodoxy and Russian Orthodoxy. They have a doctrine called theosis, which is the idea that you are elevated at salvation. Salvation just literally means becoming God. Right, so theosis means that you are elevated into the divine, and they would go to like 1 Peter 1, where Peter says we are now partakers of the divine nature. They would explain that in a very literal way, where you really do have this divine nature, this divine imprimatur on your very nature, in such a way that you are now divine.
I think maybe the interpreting that there is an essence of the divine within us, and that when salvation does come, that we are then moved to that higher level of divine being. But I would argue to that, to say that everyone is God is to say also that no one is God, because
well, that's a good point.
I mean, if their argument is we all have this divine nature and we're all raised to the level of God, well, then there isn't one, because we're all God. Then maybe they're saying we're all one being, I don't know, but you can't say that we'd each be individually God. You could maybe say, as possibly some Christians believe, that there are, again, there's maybe a hierarchy still, even in the divine, that that you do have an all-powerful God, and then there are those that come below him in different levels of hierarchy, maybe.
Yeah, what they actually are, though, trying to say that you've been elevated into the divine nature. Now, the Greek Orthodox are very keen to say, we don't mean by that that you actually become literally God in the same way God is God. Okay. But they have a hard time, at least linguistically, maintaining those distinctions in a clear way. Mm. Now, this is actually the difference between Western Christianity and Eastern. Eastern Christianity is... their view of salvation focuses on ontology. It's a more ontological understanding of salvation. So that, and then that's their critique of the West. They'll say, you Westerners, you know, because in the West it's all focused on legal issues. What is my standing before God? And so that's why the debate on justification in the 16th century hit the heart of Christendom like it did, because what Luther and the Reformers were saying is, they were saying, you're right about the judicial categories in one sense. By focusing on that, you're right, but you're wrong when you set up the categories the way you do. That kind of debate probably could have never happened in the East, because they're working with different categories. They're thinking more ontologically about salvation, and they would say, your focus on the legal issues makes Christianity stale. We focus on the experiential, the ontological, and so that your very nature is raised up into the heavenlies upon salvation. Don't you get it? You know. Now, I think there were some Western Christians that did a really good job sort of synthesizing a lot of this stuff. And Aquinas, for example, would agree that upon the death of the soul, the saint does find himself being drawn into the presence of God, so that he is wholly enveloped by God. Mm-hmm. And if you want to speak of theosis in that sense, fine. The Westerners were just content to speak of the beatific vision, that there is going to be a moment in my existence, if I am saved, where I will actually see God. Mm-hmm. I will see God. I will actually know what God is. Aquinas says you can know what God is not, but you can't know what God is.
You know that?
He would say, but see, he's not saying you don't know God. He's saying you cannot fully comprehend, and not only not fully comprehend, you can't even really apprehend the essence of God because of its simplicity. And the way I've summarized Aquinas' teaching, he doesn't say this in so many words, Aquinas would say, you can't know what God is, but you can know what God is not, and you can know what God is like. And I think that's a fair summary of his teaching, even though he never actually says that. Now, given this Monophysite Christology, it may very well be that Haile Selassie may have interpreted these titles somewhat literalistically, but it's all in the context of his Monophysitism, not in the context of him making some claim like, I am the return of Christ or something like that. Yeah. But that becomes very complicated because, you know, on the one hand, he's saying this about himself, but he doesn't want to say he's the return of Christ. And he's not going to receive worship from anybody. He didn't feel comfortable doing that. So some people might say, well, this is just the problem with Monophysite Christology. You create a context in which someone could come along and claim these kinds of things within the context of his Christianity, and that still makes sense. In any case, here's a broad outline of Rastafarian history. The first stage or wave of Rastafarian history on page 152 is characterized chiefly by the work of Garvey, along with four principal founders of the religion: Archibald Dunkley, Leonard Howell, and Joseph Hibbert, and then finally Robert Hines. Jacobs gives a helpful exposition of Rastafarian presuppositions as follows. According to the Rastafarians, the doctrines of Christianity, were adapted to suit the ambitions of white imperialism. Have you ever heard the phrase that Christianity is a white man's religion?
Yes.
And were no longer adequate to fulfill the spiritual needs of the black race. In Jamaica, black ministers were regarded with contempt and disgust by the Rastafarians, who viewed them as puppets of the white ruling class and traitors to their own race. The Uncle Toms in Jamaica is basically the way they they saw them. The irony is that Haile Selassie himself was a devout Christian, a staunch member of the Ethiopian Orthodox Church, and spiritual figurehead of his own country. So again, as spiritual figurehead, he could take on certain titles, but that doesn't mean that he actually saw himself as that literally and absolutely. Indeed, it is difficult to know exactly how Selassie himself responded to the beliefs of the Rastafarians, and this is where the story of him landing in Jamaica in 1966 becomes humorous and perplexing. The emperor's arrival in Jamaica was heralded by the Rastafarians as a divine occasion. Haile Selassie's jet flew in from the east out of the dawn, and when the imperial line was seen on the fuselage, thousands of dreads broke through police lines and ran to the plane. Hundreds crouched in the shade cast by the imperial lion's wings and lit their chalices, huge flamboyant goat's horn water pipes used for smoking weed. Haile Selassie walked through the door, stood at the top of the ramp, and beheld 10,000 dreads crushed around his plane, smoking pot, chanting praises to his name, and falling on their foreheads, you know, just kind of like a Muslim in prayer, that are praying to him. He took one long look, turned around, stepped back in the plane, and had the door shut. For another hour, the emperor refused to come out. He freaked out.
Poor guy.
Now, prima facie, one gets the impression that the emperor was not comfortable with the idea that he is God, or at least the second coming of Christ. During the first wave, Rastas pored over biblical texts, giving them a new interpretation to fit the needs of their followers. These quotations, sometimes taken loosely and out of context, are interpreted freely to prove that blacks are destined to be the ultimate rulers of the world. So in Jeremiah 8:21, the KJV reads, "For the hurt of the daughter of my people, I am hurt. I am black. Astonishment hath taken hold of me." That's a description of God. So God says, "I am black," right? God is also described as a black person in the following text. "I beheld till the thrones were cast down, and the Ancient of Days did sit, whose garment was white as snow, and the hair of his head like pure wool. His throne was like the fiery flame, and his wheels as burning fire." Woolly hair is a description of sort of the hair of a black person. The Bible also indicates that the true Redeemer will come out of Ethiopia. "Glorious things are spoken of thee, O city of God, Selah. I will make mention of Rahab and Babylon to them that know me. Behold, Philistia and Tyre with Ethiopia. This man was born there. And of Zion it shall be said, this man and that man was born in her. And the highest himself shall establish her." There can be little doubt that Simon of Cyrene, the one who carried the cross of Jesus, was a black man. He's described that way in Acts 13:1. So, of course, we cannot continue. I'm not going to continue without leaving these texts just left like this. I have to point out the exegetical errors encompassing the Rasta interpretations of these texts, and I'll do it in reverse order. Concerning Simon, we have little doubt that he was either African or a Jew with a very dark complexion. What this may help us prove is that the Bible honors all races and even condemns racism. Indeed, Yahweh had harsh words to say to the siblings of Moses when they put him down for marrying an Ethiopian woman. So Moses apparently was in a mixed marriage and was made fun of for doing that, and Yahweh sided with Moses. So while we commend the Rastas for placing an emphasis upon texts which are often overlooked by white Christians, we wonder how any of this vindicates Rastafarianism. That is, how does any of this prove that God shows partiality towards any single race of people? In fact, the hope that one race will dominate the world is itself unbiblical. As Romans 2 says, "For there is no respect of persons with God." Concerning Psalm 87, this text is clearly speaking about God's desire for all people everywhere to become his children. For notice that it is Zion, another name for Jerusalem, the holy city, which is referenced here. Glorious things are destined for the holy city. For there will come a time when people all across the world will call upon the name of Yahweh and worship him as their God. On that day, it can be truly said to each person, even though you were born in Babylon or Persia or Tyre or Philistia or Egypt or Ethiopia or wherever. This is a poem. So it doesn't matter where you're from. You can say on that day, the day of your repentance, that you have been born in Zion. So Zion is a symbol of your new birth, in a sense. Again, the psalm is not suggesting that redemption comes from Ethiopia. Rather, redemption comes from Jerusalem. But the benefits of redemption are available to all. Concerning Daniel 7:9, we do have here a description of God, but notice that nowhere is he described as black. And even if he were, there is no reason to think these texts are to be taken literally, for they are admittedly drenched in simile and metaphor, so much so that these physical descriptions, like the woolly hair, must carry with them a more symbolical meaning. Finally, Jeremiah 8:21 is probably a description of the prophet himself and the sorrow he feels for Judah's impending doom. But even if it were a description of God, it cannot be taken literally, for the word black here is an allusion to the process whereby someone covers himself in ashes as an expression of deep emotional anguish. In other words, Yahweh is taking on the form of a mourner, someone who's mourning over the death of a loved one. So even if Yahweh is describing himself as black, he's taking on the description of someone who's covered themselves in ashes. Right now, Yahweh obviously doesn't do any of these things literally, but it's a symbolic gesture on his part through words saying, I'm so upset over the fact that Israel is refusing to repent, or Judah is refusing to repent. For this reason, some modern translations of Jeremiah 8:21 read, for the brokenness of the daughter of my people, I am broken. I mourn. In other words, instead of saying I am black, it says I mourn. Dismay has taken hold of me. Jacobs was right, therefore, when she noted that Rastas commonly take the Bible out of context. As we said before, the principal founders of Rastafarianism were Dunkley, Howell, Hibbert, and Hines. Howell emerged as the principal authority of the movement, with Hines as his deputy. These leaders of the first wave promoted an idealism that was both unrealistic and rebellious. Unrealistic because they naively believed they could fight the oppression of the white government of British Jamaica on its own terms. Rebellious because their rhetoric and activities against the government were audacious and often illegal. For these reasons, the leaders of the movement found themselves in jail. This undercurrent of lawlessness was not transcended until the late 60s, when reggae music became the prime medium for the movement's ideology. The music, which seems to invite rather than provoke, introduced a more sophisticated channel for delivering the Rastafarian message to the world. Marcus Garvey, of course, looms large in this initial wave of Rasta consciousness, and indeed to blacks in general. He is, after all, the first black in American history to lead a mass movement in protest of the government for equal rights and justice. He is a precursor to Martin Luther King Jr. And Malcolm X in this regard, and in fact, he is their hero. They acknowledge this. In 1952, Garvey was formally proclaimed a national hero, and since that time, Rastafarians have revered Garvey as the man who inspired their movement. His speeches are avidly read, songs and poems are written in his honor, and in the pantheon of Rastafarians, Marcus Garvey is second only to Haile Selassie. In summary, the first wave of the Rasta movement is characterized by the following traits. First, seeing Garvey's goal of the reestablishment of a home in Africa for former slaves being realized. Two, the reinterpretation of scripture in accordance with black needs, as well as the presupposition that Haile Selassie is the true Messiah. And three, fighting the white oppressors on their own terms. And then finally, spreading the message of Selassie's authority and black pride throughout the island of Jamaica. The first wave of Rastafarianism began in the 30s, ending with the close of World War II. Haile Selassie's legend had grown with his exile from Ethiopia due to the invasion of Italy and his subsequent reconquering of Ethiopia. So, you know, you have Benito Mussolini invades Ethiopia, and now he's considered the Antichrist. By the way, there were a lot of Christians that thought that too, that Benito Mussolini was the Antichrist. And so then later, Haile Selassie reconquers Ethiopia and kicks the Italians out. Well, that is looked upon by the Rastas as apocalyptic. You know, you have Christ defeating the Antichrist. Mm-hmm. So that just confirms their view. The political and spiritual doctrines of the Rastas during the second wave can be summarized as follows. Haile Selassie is the true and living God. Blacks are the reincarnation of the ancient Israelites who have been exiled to Jamaica by the whites. Though rejected by Garvey, many Rastas believed in the superiority of the black race over the white race. Jamaican politics can never save the black people from poverty, suffering, and death. In Ethiopia, there is salvation. Haile Selassie is personally arranging for the immigration of every descendant of Africa to return to their motherland. By the way, that ain't true. Haile Selassie was not doing that at all. And then finally, Babylon, the white capitalist system, will destroy itself through a nuclear holocaust. So whenever they speak of Babylon, they're talking about the white system. So America is Babylon. England is Babylon. Babylon newspapers, those are the newspapers put out by the capitalists. What is capitalism? For the Rastafarianism, capitalism is the exact same thing as corporatism. And you had these third world countries where you had the banks that would actually give out exorbitant loans to these governments that could not pay, and the interest rates would be too high. And then what would happen is that the banks would basically make a slave out of this country. And so then white Western corporations would come in and take all the natural resources as payment on the debt. So white colonialism fed into this frenzy of equating capitalism with corporatism, and in turn equating all of that with colonialism. So you can see why they're saying this. It's not like they woke up one day and just came up with these so-called stupid theories. This is not stupid. This may be wrong, but you have to actually feel some of their plight here. They are suffering at the hands of greedy bankers and corporations who were literally taking everything they have. Why can't African countries control their own diamond production? Why can't they control their own fruit production, whether it be, you know, bananas or whatever? Why are animals in Africa just being slaughtered by white trophy hunters? Why are they allowing this to happen? Well, they don't have control over their own land and their own resources. And so the cheetah, the most magnificent animal, in my opinion, one of the most magnificent animals, is dying partly because of poachers. Anyways, I could go on. And a lot of this is because they can't control their own land.
I think a point worth restating, that the first principle of this, at least during the second wave, is that Haile Selassie is the true living God, and he doesn't want to be.
Yeah, right. He never specifically made those claims for himself. Premise B, the second point, that blacks are the reincarnation of the Israelites, was perhaps the second most important Rasta teaching. Rastas during this time did little more than prepare for a time in which their deliverer would come and take them back to Africa. The dream of this exodus, which is a song that Marley sang to illustrate this point, loomed large during the second wave and did not dissipate until the emperor himself landed on the island of the sun. And he basically said, I'm not planning on taking you guys back. And as you can tell, Marley sings a song about it anyway, just to tell you how much this was deeply ingrained into their consciousness as Rastas. The second wave of Rastafarianism ended, and the third wave began when Haile Selassie came to Jamaica in 66. During a private meeting between the emperor and several Rastas, Haile Selassie told the Rastafarians not to speak or not to seek immigration to Africa.
Why would he tell them that exactly?
Because Ethiopia does not have the resources to literally move millions of people back into Ethiopia or any other African. And he doesn't have the authority to just basically guarantee an asylum in any other country. So it's not, I can't move you all back to my country, and I can't tell other African leaders what to do with their countries. So this is a pipe dream. Don't even think about it. Hence, a new ideology of liberation before migration captured the hearts of the Rastas. No one encapsulated the message better than the one who is the third most important Rastafarian personage in history. And then that, of course, is Robert Nesta Marley, Order of Merit. That OM, he received the Order of Merit, which is the highest honor a civilian can receive in Jamaica. Marley is born in 9 Miles. The birthday is February the 6th, but we're not really sure when he was born. His mother didn't make it to Kingston to get his birth certificate until weeks later, and she couldn't remember the exact day. So we say February the 6th. He could have been, a week off or a few days off before or after that.
Have you been to Balmoral's home in Jamaica?
I have. I visited 9 Miles. Have you?
No, I've been to Jamaica, but I've not been to Balmoral's home.
I couldn't go to Kingston because they were, first of all, they were redoing. I wanted to go to the Bob Marley Museum, but they were redoing it. They were refurnishing it. And I was also told there was a wave of violence going on. And so it was not a safe place to go.
It's white imperialist.
Yeah, and if you're white in some of those situations, it's just not a good thing, unfortunately. Here's the irony. Marley, he only lives to be 36 years old, so it's a very young, just a very quick rise to fame and then a very quick life and it's over. His oldest son, David Ziggy Marley, has already, outlived him. Ziggy's in his 40s. And he is the first person from the third world to have international fame as a musician. He is the product of a mixed union between Captain Norval Sinclair Marley, who's a white Englishman, and his black peasant mother, Sidella. And his daughter, beautiful girl, beautiful woman, she was part of the Melody Makers, Sidella Marley. She's named after her grandmother. So, they were married, so Bob was not born illegitimately, but they never lived together. And at one point in his life, Captain Marley kidnapped his son, but never intended on raising him and just left him in Jamaica. And it took Sidella about a year to find him. His best friend growing up was Neville Livingston, who becomes known as Bunny Wailer. He is one of the founders of the Wailers. They spent their days in 9 Miles growing up in utter poverty. Bob always had a serious disposition. Bunny reports in one of the interviews that he's done that Bob, who went by the name Nesta at the time when he was growing up, they called him Nesta. And then when he got a little older, he goes, "Mama, I want you to call me Bob," because Nesta sounds like I'm a little kid. But he growing up, he was kind of shunned because his skin was too light. So you see, he's white, and then, of course, no white person wanted him. So he actually did not have many friends growing up. The closest thing that he had to a father figure at the time was his grandfather, Omera Malcolm, who was, among other things, sort of the patriarch of the community and involved himself in witchcraft and sorcery and things like that. He would spend his nights listening to stories by the older folks, tales of how the great Ali Selassie overthrew Mussolini. Also, on occasion, he ran into what villagers call the Black Heart Man. That was what people called the Rastafarians. And so Bunny Wailer put out one of the greatest reggae albums ever is the Black Heart Man. And the opening song is Bunny's journey from seeing the Black Heart Band as something to be despised to him becoming a Black Heart Band, to him becoming a Rastafarian. They moved to Kingston with their parents, Sadella and Toddy Livingston. Sadella and Toddy will live together and produce a girl named Pearl. So they actually share a stepsister. And then Pearl will grow up and have a relationship with Peter Tosh. And Peter Tosh and Pearl will produce Andrew Tosh, who's now a reggae singer. So Andrew Tosh is not just the son of Peter, but he's the nephew of both Bunny and Bob. So it's fun how all that stuff works out. In the early 60s, there was a musical genre called ska that was on the rise. What happens is Jamaica gets independent from Britain. Britain, in the wake of World War II, Britain has to basically sell off all of its property to pay off its World War II debt. So the victory, the cost of victory in World War II was the end of the British Empire. And so Gandhi had very little to do with Indian independence. Britain had to get rid of their crown jewel colony. They formally were no longer the rulers of Canada, and they got rid of all of their Caribbean colonies too. And one of them, the big money maker that they had since the 1650s, was Jamaica. And what was their money maker? Why were they such a money maker? Sugar. Europe never tasted sugar until the New World was discovered.
That's great.
And Europe had a sugar tooth big time when they first tasted that stuff.
I can imagine.
Because their climate, you know, sugar cane has to be, grown in very warm climates. Mm-hmm. And up there in Europe, you know, you don't have a whole lot of sugar cane growing. And so even when the 13 colonies rebel against England, it's not like England was hurting all that much because they still had Jamaica. But they get rid of Jamaica. Jamaica is independent by 1962. And so ska comes on the scene, kind of a quick up-tempo version of calypso. So if you know that song, Deo, Deo. That's Harry Belafonte, right? So that's kind of the classic Caribbean sound. And then ska was for the young people. It was the up-tempo beat that launches from that all the kids would go to, and they danced all this stuff. So they were dancing to that while, excuse me, while people in America were dancing to Elvis and doing the twist and all that stuff. Bob Marley cut his first track as a solo track. It was called Judge Not. And then within a year, he and Bunny form the Wailers with Peter Tosh, Junior Braithwaite, Sherry Green, and Beverly Kelso. And as Bob will later say, eventually Junior split, the two girls split, and that left Peter, Bunny, and Bob to carry on the Wailers. Their first song, Simmer Down, was a song that spoke against the violence going on in Kingston, and they were telling the gangs to simmer down. And overnight it became a national hit. They were eventually the number one ska group in the 60s. The biggest problem facing them is that they didn't get adequate payment for their songs. They would go into a studio and work all day and produce these songs, and they would get pennies on the dollar. The producers were the ones that made all the money. Bob will meet and fall in love with Rita during this time, during the mid to late 60s. They're married in 1966, the very year that Ali Selassie comes, but Bob is not in Jamaica when Ali Selassie comes to Jamaica. He goes to Delaware. His mother had moved up to Delaware, and he will spend a year working three or four jobs around the clock to build up capital to come back and start his own studio. By the end of the 60s, after he moves back, and Rita tells Bob all about Ali Selassie's visit, and she was convinced because she thought that she saw the crucifixion mark on Ali Selassie's hand. So she says, you know, I saw Christ reincarnate. Bob converts eventually. Peter, of course, converts, and they begin growing their hair out. So if you look at the old pictures of the Whalers, they had very short hair. They would wear suits, you know, and all of that. But then when they became Rastas, they rebelled against all of that, and so they grew out their hair into dreadlocks. That is taken from number 6 in the Torah, the Nazirite vow. Samson is described as somebody with 7 locks, that he grew out his hair and he had 7 big locks. Well, that's where they get that. So they see themselves as following a kind of Nazirite vow. They follow the dietary laws of the Torah. They do not believe in drugs. They don't see herb as a drug. They see it as a gift from God to smoke to his glory and all of that. So that's what's going on. They move from rock steady to reggae. And so what they do is they take all their old songs, and they even write new ones during this time, and they turn them into reggae songs. So the Rastamen poured out songs of love towards their women, Stir It Up. Love towards humanity, One Love. Protest against war and oppression, 400 years, that's a Peter Tosh song. No More Trouble, Concrete Jungle, Slave Driver, which is a classic. Threats against their enemies, Stepping Razor, and The Toughest. Those are Bunny and Peter songs. And then Small Axe. They also have a Rastamon chant, which is a praise to Jah Rastafari. Their first two albums, which received little attention outside Jamaica, were Soul Rebels and Soul Revolution. Chris Blackwell will discover the Whalers. He actually produced Bob's first song, Judge Not, but it was under the wrong name, Robert Morley, instead of Robert Marley. And so Chris Blackwell produces that, but he doesn't even know who this Robert Morley is. And then, of course, immediately Bob goes into the Whalers, and they're just called the Whalers. They're not called Bob Marley and the Whalers. They're just the Whalers. And so Chris Blackwell doesn't know who this person is. But he hears them from some of their albums put out by Lee Perry, and he becomes interested in them, and he signs them with Island Records. And this is the same label that signed U2. So this is to tell you how big they become. This launches them into international stardom. Their first international release from Island is Catch a Fire. And they took a lot of those songs I just mentioned and put it on Catch a Fire. And it's got a far more polished reggae vibe to it. And then you have Burnin', which is the follow-up album. And people have called that the best album, the most innovative release since the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper's. So those were two fantastic albums. While on tour, Blackwell began pushing Bob to take on the role as leader, and he even would bill them on the marquee as Bob Marley and the Whalers. And this is what caused the split in the band. And so Bunny never really liked touring. He hated the cold weather. And Peter didn't like the rivalry. And so Bunny and Peter left the band after the Burnin' tour. And then Bob, of course, will put out Natty Dread, his first release. And now that album is under Bob Marley and the Whalers. Mm-hmm. And then he gets his wife and two other women, Judy Mowat and Marcia Griffiths, to back him up. And so they are called the I3s. And so you see this big transition in the way the band functions. And the band is huge. I mean, he's got 2 or 3 lead guitarists, Junior Marvin and Al Anderson. I've met those guys. But I was 18 at the time I met them, and I asked them just a bunch of stupid questions that only a moron would ask. I'm embarrassed by that. And he had a great rhythm section, Family Man Barrett and Carlton Barrett. Carlton was murdered in 1987, the same year that Peter Tosh was murdered. Wire Lindo, that's the keyboardist, along with Tyrone Downey. He's another keyboardist. Seiko Patterson, percussion. Great band. All these local guys. And Bob was always loyal to them. I think Junior Marvin was English. But the point is that he was always loyal to these guys. They were always a part of the band. Once you joined the Whalers, you were part of the Whalers. He released his fourth LP for Island entitled Rossmann Vibration. And during that year, an assassination attempt was made on his life. He would not take sides in the upcoming local election, the Jamaican election for who would be prime minister. And so some of the representatives of the party went to his home and gunned him down. And what happened was he heard some rustling outside that sounded suspicious. So he tried to make himself, you know, sort of small because he didn't have time to move because he saw the people running. And they opened fire on him. And the first bullet grazed his sternum and lodged into his arm. And when the other shots came, by that time his manager had walked in the way. And so Don Taylor got just shot up, just almost died. He had a near-death experience. But he himself survived that. Rita also got shot in the head, and she survived. And so he escapes Jamaica after doing the Smile Jamaica concert. He actually performed a few days later. Despite all protests, he went out there and basically just invited the gunmen to, look, I'm still standing here. Took a lot of guts. And because people were saying, like, they're going to show up and kill you. But then he left and spent a few years in England. Because what he was most hurt by was the fact that he knew the people that did this. And the fact that his own fellow Jamaicans would take a side in what is ultimately an international issue. One of the reasons why this happened may very well be that the CIA tried to kill him. He actually has a line in his in the Rossmann Vibration album. He has a line in the song Rat Race where he says, Rasta don't work for no CIA. And so he's really going after the CIA. And it turned out that the CIA was funding one of the parties in this election. They were smuggling arms into Jamaica. And that's why there was so much violence in the streets.
How many countries have we done that to?
Yeah, we've done that to a lot of countries. In fact, Kissinger swore that there was no way that America was involved in the violence in Jamaica. And we've had CIA operatives say now, yeah, we were involved. So Kissinger lied. He just lied through his teeth, saying that we were not in any way affecting these elections. A year after, he releases Exodus while he's in England. And that album, of course, is given the title for obvious reasons. And then he writes another album called Kaya, which is almost entirely love songs. All these albums are just really good. He also hosts the One Love Peace concert where he gets the two political rivals, Edward Siaga and Michael Manley, to come up and shake hands. And Peter Tosh will later write a song called Peace Treaty where he says that didn't really amount to anything. In 1979, there was the release of Survival, which is my favorite of all of Bob Marley's albums. It's the beginning of a trilogy. You have Survival. And then after we survive as a people, you have Uprising. So that's the next album that comes. And then after he released that album, he goes on tour. And while he's on tour, he collapses in, I guess it's in Central Park. He plays in Philadelphia. And then I think, or is it Pittsburgh? Gosh, I'm embarrassed. He plays in either Pittsburgh or Philadelphia, and then he runs to, he goes to Central Park, and he's jogging in Central Park, and he collapses. Why does he collapse? Because he has melanoma. The cancer had started in his toe, and the doctors told him to amputate the toe, and then maybe amputate the foot. And he's a Rastafarian, doesn't believe in amputation. Plus, he hated the idea that he would not be allowed to dance on stage. And so he just ignores it. After a surgery, he ignores it, and it literally eats up his whole body. So during that tour, he has to cancel it. And he does receive the highest honor in, that you can receive as a citizen in April of 1981, and he will be dead within a month of that. that is basically his life in a nutshell. The Confrontation album was going to be the third part of that trilogy, so it was released after his death. Solid album. And then, of course, Legend is the one of the all-time greatest selling albums of all time. That's a compilation of his best hits. Most people have that one. And then, of course, there's a box set called Redemption Songs, which I love because it gives you his stuff that you've never heard before. There's one of my favorites is a recording of him just getting, you know, doing his voice exercises before a concert. And they just have this, they have like a 10-minute recording of him just singing some, a lot of his songs, trying to get his voice ready to perform. It's awesome.
Does Rita still have material too that she's releasing?
She has a vault of well over 36 songs, at least, probably more, that have never been heard before. And like some of the songs that were released on the box set were before never heard songs. So like Iron Lion Zion, that had never been heard before. That was an old Wailers tune that Bunny and Peter were a part of. Bob is the only one of the three Wailers to never receive an Emmy. Or, I'm sorry, not an Emmy, but a Grammy. Never received one. Well, they didn't have Best Reggae Artist at the time. Ziggy has received multiple Grammys, and so have Peter. And Peter received one, and then Bonnie Wailer has received multiple ones. Some people believe now that the Grammy is just a Marley show. It's just for the Marleys, because if it's not Ziggy that's getting one, it's going to be Damien or one of the other brothers. One of the more interesting facts about Bob's final days, this is on page 161, is his religious conversion. Unbeknownst to the leaders of the Rasta community, Rita had Bob baptized in the Ethiopian Orthodox Church on November the 4th, 1980. Taking the name Berhan Selassie, he became what he called himself, a Christian Rasta. Now that is a brief line in Timothy White's book, Catch a Fire. I have since learned, and there's a whole article on it, that this was an intense experience for Bob. He actually trusted in Christ as his Lord and Savior, wept over this fact, and for the months before and after, consulted the Ethiopian Orthodox priest who baptized him. And the Ethiopian Orthodox priest has gone on record to say, yeah, this was a very serious thing for him, and that all of the Marleys are technically members of this church. This has made me wonder, why are the Marleys still promoting Rasta if you were baptized in the Orthodox Church? And I think it's because of money, because Americans especially love the other. They love what is different. Mm-hmm. They love what is sort of weird and strange and mysterious. And it's the mysticism, it's the mysterious nature of Rastafarianism that draws a lot of Westerners to Bob's music. And most Americans think it's just really cool. You got this guy with long matted hair smoking pot all day, and they think that that's what it's all about. But if you listen to the lyrics of his music is more about political oppression and helping those who are in need. I mean, a lot of the Bible verses that I know, I get from Bob Marley, because he just spends his songs just quoting so much Bible. Because that's all he did. He read the Bible, read the newspaper, and then made songs out of it. But he does have a conversion experience near the end of his life where he embraces Christ as his Savior. It would be interesting if we could peer into an alternative universe and see what would have become of Bob had he lived to a ripe old age. We would like to think that his step into the church was the first of many away from Rastafarianism. How could such an intelligent man come to believe that an Ethiopian emperor was God, especially when Rastafari himself never made such a claim? The late 1950s saw the deaths of the emperor's son, Selah, along with his wife and two daughters. Selassie himself became grief-stricken as a result and was never able to fully gain control of his faculties. By the time he visited Jamaica in 1966, Ethiopia was ready to enter into the modern era by breaking free from the 2,000-year-old monarchy. In 1970 and 1972, a series of droughts caused a famine throughout Ethiopia. A combination of pride and incompetence kept the emperor from providing any substantive relief for his famished subjects. 1973 then brought a torrent of rain that eroded what little topsoil remained, and by 1975, nearly 1 million people died by famine, disease, or violence, which often broke out in the refugee camps. Emperor Haile Selassie was forced to consent to a constitutional monarchy in 1974 and was eventually forced to give up his title in 1975. After his departure, Ethiopia broke out into a civil war between Marxist-Leninist factions and those who opposed the new alliance with the Soviet Union. Haile Selassie himself was dead by August of 1975. When Marley heard of the emperor's death, he immediately wrote and recorded the song Jah Live, which was released as a single. He comforted his fellow Rastas with the words, "Fools say in their heart, Rasta, your God is dead. But I know, Jah Jah, dreaded, it shall be dreaded and dread. Jah Live." And what he basically means there is that dread is the word for cleanliness, but it's also a term used to describe fear that may suddenly overtake a man. So Marley is here saying that those who say that Rasta, their God, is dead, will dread the day of judgment, and Jah will one day make all things new or clean, for the war against evil is not over. That's what he's saying with those words. When he journeyed to Ethiopia a few years later, he wept as he stood over the unadorned grave of his God. However, we must insist, with all due respect for the wailers, their music, and their justified complaint concerning the political and spiritual oppression of black people all over the world, that the day Haile Selassie died was the day Marley should have abandoned faith in his Messiah, and for that matter, all the wailers. It may very well be the case that the emperor went on to a better place, and hence is not dead in that sense. But he is not God. The proof is not only found in the fact that he never rose from the dead, but also in the fact that he never clearly claimed to be divine. According to the Bible, when the Messiah comes, there will be an everlasting peace and prosperity for all people all over the world. Contrast this biblical promise with Haile Selassie's last days. We must also take issue with the Rastafarian worldview. Outwardly, the Rastaman is a theist who embraces the authority of the Bible, which is doubtlessly a monotheistic text. But when we look under the surface, we find the Rastaman embracing a pantheistic worldview that is contrary to their own purported authority. Indeed, their preferred term for marijuana is ganja, which was originally imported from India centuries ago. The term is related to Kali, Indian goddess of both destruction and sensuality. Smoking ganja is the means by which the Rastaman breaks down the illusion of sensuality and destruction and materialism that surrounds him. As Jacobs explains, to the Rastafarians, the herb is the key to new understanding of the self, the universe, and God. Man basically is God, but this insight can come to man only with the use of the herb. When you use the herb, you experience yourself as God. With the use of the herb, you can exist in this dismal state of reality that now exists in Jamaica. You cannot change man, but you can change yourself with the use of the herb. When you are God, you deal with or relate to people like God. In this way, you let your light shine, and when each of us lets his light shine, we are created a godlike. We are creating a godlike culture, and this is the cosmic unity that we try to achieve in the Rastafarian community. One of the goals, then, of the Rastaman is to find the God within through the smoking of herb or ganja. This is just another form of pantheism, which is both irrational and contrary to biblical teaching. This also creates further tension in the Rastaman's worldview, for if Selassie is God merely in the sense that we all are, why is he worshipped? If he is unique, what becomes a Rasta pantheism? These dialectical tensions indicate that Bob was right to journey to the church, for it is only in the faith of Abraham where we find a consistent theism. All right, how are we doing? We're about to make a transition, but you want to, do you have any questions over Rastafarianism? You can see what I'm doing here. At the very end, I make that statement as a good segue into Abrahamic theism. So, anyway.
I was always interested in knowing what it was. I've always had a taste for reggae music, and I always knew that it was very politically charged. I mean, if you pay any attention to the lyrics whatsoever, you can tell that. But also just kind of the heart of the music, you can tell it is both painful, celebratory in some ways, very spiritual, and I've always really liked, I've always really enjoyed it. But I always understood that it was more than just good music, you know?
No, in fact, I've never been like a huge fan of the music per se. I love the beat to it, and some of the flashes of improvisation on like guitar playing and all that is nice. Junior Marvin brought a lot to the Wailers when he, you know, he would just go off on these tangents with his guitar, which was really fun. Like if you, I've watched a lot of their concerts, you know. but it, for me, it's always been the lyrics, the music. Yeah, I mean, people used to laugh at me and they say, "Travis, why do you like that crap? It's just the same song over and over again." I said, "But the lyrics, you know, it's just the lyrics are so good that that was what always drew me to it."
Off the record,
sure,
or not really. But what's your perspective on marijuana as a?
It is stupid and moronic for the government to declare it illegal. I believe that you should be able to do with your body what you will as a legal matter. Now, ethically, I think it's immoral to take drugs as a form of recreation.
So you consider it a drug?
Yeah, I would consider marijuana a drug of sorts. And so I used to smoke a lot of pot in my day.
I did too.
But then,
my day, I guess I'm still
back in my day. But you know, I actually, it was in, you know, high school and college that I did. And then I went to a Jimmy Cliff concert, another great reggae artist. And I was high the whole weekend, basically. And I just felt really weird. And I remember, after that experience, I just said, "I'm never going to smoke pot again," and I never have. It was 1989, so that was, we're looking at almost 30 years.
Before I was born.
Yeah. But I just, it really is terrible for you. I mean, it's just horrible for you. People that smoke marijuana can't really concentrate well on things. It just, if you have ADD, it just is ratcheted up. From that, if you, it's not good for your lungs. It is good for some things like glaucoma. They can use the marijuana plant to help heal those kinds of things.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of ways in which, hemp and marijuana can replace sort of plastics. I mean, Ziggy Marley, he has a company now where they're putting out all kinds of hemp products that actually is good for the environment. And I'm all for that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And I will also say this. I do believe, and as I just said a minute ago, I believe that legally it should be, people should be allowed to do it. I just also think that ethically the Christian should not do it, because I think that Paul's statement, "Don't be drunk with wine," is really just an overall statement. Do not abuse any sort of drug that's out there.
Yeah.
Now, having said all of that, let's say that marijuana will probably be legalized in all the states eventually.
Yeah. In the next 20 years, yeah.
And assuming that that is true, this point will not be that important. But let's say that we had a big reversal. Let's say Trump just goes on a tirade and we have a big reversal and all of the states where it's legalized, it just becomes illegal, right? And so marijuana is absolutely legal. You can't use it medically or any other way. And let's also assume that I was diagnosed with cancer. On that day, I would gladly break the law and take the medical marijuana. Mm-hmm. I would use it as a medication because that's an oppressive law that is basically depriving me of my right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It is, in principle, unconstitutional. So I do believe that there are times when breaking the law is a good thing, and that is when the government is telling me what I can and cannot do with respect to worship, and or if the law is intrinsically oppressive, and it clearly a law that would tell someone that they can't use marijuana to help themselves medically is an oppressive law. It is not your business to tell somebody else how to treat themselves. Mm-hmm. So
unless they should so ask. But I think we, I think we agree. I did it, smoked consistently from freshman year of high school when I was introduced to it by my older brother up until about a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I too, there are moments where, thankfully, I mean, I don't believe that it itself is addictive. I believe that its effects can be, and that certain people have characteristics that can cause them to become addicted to it. And my roommate did in college, and he is what really kind of turned me off from it, because he became obsessed over it, and to the point where it was just constant consumption. I mean, he would turn himself into a vegetable as much as he could, as often as he could. He would take 6 bong hits in a row, and he would just lay on the couch and become a vegetable. And I never had that problem, but to see that and to witness that to me was enough to say, there's something here that's just, you know, it cannot be a good thing. And I'm with you. I'm an advocate for medical use of it. And in fact, I think that my grandpa should be using it as medication, because he's on all these opioids that are quite frankly killing him faster than anything else.
Yeah, and if we're going to talk about drugs, I've always said that all the drugs should be legalized. I mean, you know, it's just not the government's job to regulate what you put into your body. I will also say that if I'm going to get in the business of deciding which drug we should make illegal, I'd start with a lot of the pharmaceuticals.
Yeah.
Because the stuff they're cooking up in a lab is far more harmful than, say, pure heroin. Like, pure heroin is far safer than, you know, like you said, the opioids that people are cooking up. So synthetic stuff is just, is scary. It's scarier to me than anything else.
Yeah, and I agree with you very much there. But I think, you know, it just briefly again, as far as like a personal conviction, I just reached those moments where it was like, it was very clear that there's, it puts you in a certain state of mind that is just not healthy, you know. I mean, it's strange.
The deceptive
feel to you in some ways that you, in some ways, are unaware of.
Right.
There's feelings that come up, and it's just very clear that it's not the right thing to be doing.
The deceptive nature of it is that most people that smoke pot on a regular basis, they think that their minds are getting clear. I think that the only way you can really function in life and smoke pot on a regular basis is if you have the life of like a rock star. Otherwise, you're not going to be able to function because your analytical skills are just shot to hell.
Yeah. You cannot.
So that's why, I mean, Bob was a genius when it came to writing music.
Yeah.
And he smoked every single day.
Yeah. You cannot think.
But I think he's an exception that proves the rule. I mean, he's one of the all-time greatest lyricists that I've ever read. I mean, I've mad respect for people like Billy Joel, on the one hand, John Lennon, Paul McCartney. I mean, these guys, their lyrics are genius. Bob Dylan. I mean, I could go on and on and on. And I'm sure a lot of, I know that the Beatles, they got into acid and all that stuff, but unless you're living the kind of lifestyle already that allows for it, which means that you either have to be very rich or extremely poor. See, Bob is very poor. He has nothing to lose. He's not getting up doing the 9-to-5 thing. You know what I mean? He's already in the slums. So the only thing that they have is music and pot. And I'm being a little facetious, but not much.
Yeah.
The Beatles get into their drug scene after they become famous. So they have time to kill.
Yeah.
But what if you're working from 8 to 5 every day and you're trying to take care of a family and you smoke pot every single day?
Can't happen.
You're just not going to be able to do it.
Yeah, I realize that too. It's just not. It's not livable.
It's like not a livable lifestyle. It's just it's not. It's not.
You can't. You can't function.
But diagnosed with me with cancer tomorrow, God forbid. But diagnosed. If I'm diagnosed with cancer, I'm going to start smoking pot again. And I'm not. I don't. I wouldn't make any bones about it. I mean, I just don't think that it literally. They're because that is a situation in which I need it for. Other reasons. It helps with the pain. I mean, it really helps with so many things. So Bob was like, the herb is good for so many things. And he wasn't wrong. It's just like, but I also know people that so immerse themselves into the drug culture that when they really need those painkillers at a later time in their life, it doesn't help them. Because their bodies become so inoculated, if you will, from any sort of painkiller. So that's another problem with recreational drug use. It's not going to help you when you really need it if you use it at a young age for a long time. Well, let's go ahead and transition then from marijuana to God, which Mark said religion is the opiate of the people, and so maybe this is appropriate. This is the new handout I gave you.
Okay, got it.
Do you have it?
Yes.
Abrahamic theism. One will notice that there are two kinds of pagan theism. Namely, one that relies solely on reason to construct a doctrine of God. Deism, Aristotelianism, and Platonism would be the examples that we gave. And those which depend either directly or indirectly on the teachings found in the Judeo-Christian or Islamic scriptures. Sikhism, Baha'i, Scientology, and Rastafarianism. As for the former, we have seen that neither Platonism nor Aristotelianism, Plato or Aristotle, were able to come up with an adequate view of God, nor were they able to resolve the tensions within their respective epistemologies. One wonders whether deism would have ever been articulated wholly apart from the Judeo-Christian milieu in which it arose. Thus, while deism claims to be wholly independent of Scripture, it is far more likely that the founders of deism would never have abandoned their position if they had never been raised as Christians, or at least in Judeo-Christian culture. Regardless, we have seen that some of the major tenets of deism actually serve to undermine this worldview. As for the latter, these pagan theisms are admittedly, according to their own proponents, dependent upon the Judeo-Christian Islamic scriptures for their understanding of God. This leaves us with ISKCON, along with our perplexity over the fact that it took thousands of years for an explicitly monotheistic expression to surface among the indigenous peoples of India. Would we not expect that, after hundreds of years of Muslim rule in India, an Indian thinker, like Caitanya, would express himself as a monotheist, insisting that the Hindu scriptures themselves allow for this understanding of God? So you get the point I'm making? You don't get explicit monotheisms except in those places where the Judeo-Christian Islamic worldview it dominates or at least has had an effect on that culture. All of this forces us to face squarely the following question. If so many thinkers have sought to integrate their philosophical theism with what can be found in the Bible and or the Quran, only failing to yield for us a consistent view of God in the process, is it not obvious that we should turn to these scriptures to see what view of God is expressed in these texts, along with whether or not that view of God is inconsistent or consistent? And this, of course, brings us to Abrahamic theism. We call it theism since all proponents within the traditions believe that there is only one personal being we call God who is infinite in power, knowledge and goodness, and we call it Abrahamic theism, since according to these traditions, this understanding of God was bequeathed to a man named Abraham through a special act of revelation by God himself around 2000 BC. The reader must appreciate where we are in our journey. Indeed, all of the other views of God we have shown or looked at have been shown to be self-defeating and or insufficient, and therefore false. Abrahamic theism is the only view of God that remains. If it can be shown that Abrahamic theism is also self-defeating or insufficient, then we will have proven that no God of any kind exists. In this section, we will therefore explore three major questions. First, who are the major proponents of Abrahamic theism? Second, what are the core beliefs that all or nearly all Abrahamic theists have in common? And third, how should we evaluate theism? That is to say, what are some of the more important contributions theists have made to humanity, and can theism survive an internal critique of its core beliefs? So here are the versions of Abrahamic theism. And you can actually divide Abrahamic theism into two types of versions. When we talk about the expression of Abrahamic theism, you can either talk about the religious expression of Abrahamic theism or the philosophical expression of Abrahamic theism. Let's first look at the religious one. The religious expression of Abrahamic theism falls into three religions, basically: Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. Judaism is the religion of the Jews, and it takes its name from the word Judah, which was perhaps the most venerable tribe of the ancient Hebrew people. The Jews believe in one personal and infinite God who has revealed himself chiefly in the Torah, the first five books of Moses, as well as the prophetic and sacred writings, like Isaiah and the Psalms. Jews also stress the intimate link between ethics and God, and are therefore to be credited with giving the world an ethical monotheism. Okay, so in other words, unlike Plato, who said that gods had nothing to do with the good transcends the gods, in fact, the Hebrews said, no, God is the locus of all moral value. Hence, the motto of the Jew is deed over creed, for what we do is far more important than what we believe. The most important Jewish theologians outside of Moses and the prophets include Hillel, Gamaliel, Judah the Prince, Sa'adja Gaon, Moses Maimonides, Nachmanides, Solomon Maimon, Martin Buber, and Abraham Heschel, just to name a few. Christianity. For the Jew, Christianity is a mere offshoot of their religion. For the Christian, it is the fulfillment of Judaism. Christianity is a religion chiefly centered around the person of Christ, whom the Christian church worships as divine. According to the New Testament, Jesus Christ came in the world to save human sinners from the consequence of their sins or moral failings. He did this to fulfill the prophecies recorded in the writings of Moses and the prophets. And according to the story, the grand proof that he was who the church claimed him to be was his resurrection from the dead. The most important Christian theologians or thinkers besides Jesus and the apostles include St. Augustine, St. Anselm, St. Thomas Aquinas, Martin Luther, John Calvin, Jonathan Edwards, Karl Barth, and C.S. Lewis. Islam.
Among others.
Yeah, among others. There are plenty more. Islam. Islam means submission. And Muslim means one who submits. And I can't tell you how many times I've heard people say, he's an Islam. No, he's a Muslim. Islam refers to the religion. Muslim refers to the person who adopts the religion. To whom does the Muslim submit? He submits to Allah, or God, because he is an absolutely sovereign and supreme will that creates, sustains, and directs all things towards his predetermined ends. Muhammad, the founder of this religion, is considered to be the last of the great prophets in Islam and stands in the same line of succession as Abraham, Moses, David, and Jesus. The revelations given to Muhammad are now recorded in the Quran, which is a book that is about the same size as the Christian's New Testament. Muslims believe that if one sincerely recites the sacred creed, there is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet, and then one immediately becomes a Muslim once they recite the creed. And beyond that, a good Muslim will follow all the five pillars of Islam. And the five pillars of Islam are reciting the sacred creed, that makes you a Muslim, pray five times a day facing Mecca, make at least one pilgrimage to Mecca within one's lifetime, and if you can't do that, one goes in your stead, right? Fast during the month of Ramadan and then give alms to the poor. The most important theologians outside of Muhammad and his caliphs include Al-Ghazali, Averroes, Avicenna, Rumi, Muhammad ibn Abd al-Wahhab, and Abdullah Yusuf Ali. What are the core beliefs of the Abrahamic theists? While Jews, Christians, and Muslims have different differences that are very important, which cannot be harmonized, and that means that each religion is irreconcilable with the other. They also have quite a few beliefs they hold in common. It seems that the rational approach to Abrahamic theism is to first note what these faiths have in common, and if these common core beliefs can stand up to rational scrutiny, then one may move on to discover which religious expression of Abrahamic theism is true. If Abrahamic theism cannot survive an internal critique, then there is no point in adjudicating the conflicting truth claims of Jews, Muslims, and Christians. Does that make sense?
So
let's say that I've proven that this view of God can't be true because it's self-defeating. Then there's no point in me going on to try to figure out whether Christianity is more plausibly true than Judaism or Islam, because there just is no God.
Right.
But if I do conclude that such a God can withstand an internal critique, then it does make sense for me to go on to see which is more plausibly true.
Okay.
And here are the core beliefs of Abrahamic theists. Metaphysical dualism. While monists tell us that all is one and pluralists tell us that all is many, dualists insist that there are only two kinds of reality, God and the world. God, then, is clearly distinct from the creation, and hence the desire to associate God with anything in the created order is blasphemous to any Abrahamic theist. Monotheism. If there is anything Judaism affirms, it is the insistence that there is only one God. Indeed, while the Jews are often proud of the fact that they emphasize deed over creed, belief in the one true God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel is essential. If there is a Jewish creed, then it is found in the following passage, which is known as the Shema. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, or Yahweh our God, Yahweh is one. That's Deuteronomy 6:4. According to the Hebrew Bible, the one God is nothing if he is not at least the following. He has to be omnipotent. He has to be omniscient. And he has to be omnibenevolent. In other words, he has to be all-powerful, all-knowing, and all-good. If you go on page 168, I give you some biblical references. For example, that these attributes are absolutely non-negotiable in historic biblical Judaism seems clear when we know that God reveals himself as the Almighty while introducing the sign of the covenant. So here he is introducing the sign of covenant to Abraham, and he goes, I am the Lord Almighty, or I am God Almighty, indicating that Yahweh is surely able to fulfill his covenant with Abraham. According to the tradition, David celebrates the omniscience of God throughout Psalm 139, and elsewhere, the Hebrew Bible affirms that God's understanding is infinite. Also, the psalmist insists that righteousness and justice are the foundation of God's throne, while the prophet Isaiah, in his famous vision, encounters the Lord whose holiness is proclaimed from his very throne by the angels. Both Christianity and Islam follow their Jewish friends in affirming the existence of an omnipotent, omniscient, and omnibenevolent deity. Thus, Jesus tells us that there is no one good but God alone, that God the Father knows all, and that nothing is impossible for him. The Quran agrees with all of this. God is the self-subsistent one who knows all, can do all, and is the provider of every good. Creation ex nihilo, this is the next presupposition. It means creation out of nothing. God has no competitors. There are no other gods besides him. No Zeus, no Jupiter, no Athena, no Ganesha, no Vishnu, no Brahman. That's what the disciples of Abraham say. But the Abrahamic theist wants to say more than this. Even creation itself cannot compete with God, for unlike God, the cosmos is not eternal. It came into existence from absolutely nothing but the sovereign will of the omnipotent God. Traditionally, most Abrahamic theists have insisted that this doctrine, important for securing the absolute distinction between creator and creation, must be accepted simply on faith. There is no proof of this doctrine except the authority of Holy Writ. Interestingly, the Hebrew Bible, the New Testament, and the Quran all affirm that God created and now sustains the universe in existence. And I cite texts, of course, showing that. Revelational epistemology. This is the next presupposition of the Abrahamic theist. At the end of chapter 1, we address the issue of our source of knowledge. Where does knowledge come from? We noted in that chapter that while the majority of human philosophers have rightly embraced foundationalism as the means whereby we structure our knowledge claims, there is no way for human beings on their own to offer a source of knowledge, since mysticism, rationalism, and empiricism are each encumbered by a host of difficulties. This took us on a search for the true worldview. And we insisted that an important feature of an adequate worldview is that it provides us with the preconditions or source of knowledge. The finite gods of the polytheists cannot give us the preconditions of knowledge, since they themselves depend upon a source for their understanding. Finite creatures, whether human or divine, cannot think autonomously. The pantheistic one is impersonal, cannot think rationally, and hence cannot be the source of knowing. The process philosophies of Buddha and Whitehead can only give us a self and process who can neither survive the moment nor grasp the moment with its mind. Plato and Aristotle, as we have seen, also failed to provide us with adequate epistemologies, while the other pagan theists themselves turned to the Judeo-Christian and or Islamic scriptures to shore up their own philosophies and inadequacies. It is to the Abrahamic theist's credit that he at least offers the location of the human source of knowledge and an all-knowing mind who is able to reveal truth to his creatures. For the Abrahamic theist, all truth is ultimately understood as a divine revelation. The act of revelation is the act whereby God unveils what was previously hidden to the minds of humans. All of nature is a revelation of God, as are the scriptures. Had God not, in his wisdom and grace, designed the human mind with the capacity to know, and had he not providentially led humans to progressively realize and understand truth, there would be no knowledge. The Hebrew Bible affirms that it is in God's own light that we see light, and the New Testament affirms that it is the divine mind alone where all the treasures of wisdom, understanding, and knowledge are found. Anthropology. Anthropology is the study of human beings. While we cannot articulate everything the common Abrahamic theist believes about humans, we should at least know that the most important element to the Judeo-Christian conception of humans is that each and every person has intrinsic value because, if for no other reason, each human is made in the image of God. This doctrine is given in the Hebrew Bible and reaffirmed in the New Testament. All humans, then, are to be treated with dignity and respect, if for no other reason than that everyone bears the image of God. Another important inference to be made from this doctrine is that here, in the doctrine of the Imago Dei, we have a basis for saying that humans are able to know God. Because we are in some sense like God, we can know him truly. However, because human beings are not God, he is infinite, we are finite, we can never know him exhaustively. God can be apprehended, he can be known truly, but he cannot be comprehended, he cannot be known exhaustively. Ethics. For the Jew, it is not enough for one to believe that there is a God. One must have an ethical component to belief in God. Thus, many refer to this element as ethical monotheism. Judaism divides those laws necessary for all to follow into two broad categories or kinds, namely those for the Gentiles and those for the Jews. Gentiles need only worry about the laws governing their own conscience, along with the commandments given to all peoples immediately after the Great Flood. Jews must live under the Torah, the law, or the instruction, which divides its laws into those which are obeyed by the Levites, men, women, and so forth. This involves following the Ten Commandments and observing the rituals concerning sacrifices and feast days throughout the Jewish calendar. Sacrifices involve the killing of an animal as an atonement for sin. The feast days include the Passover, celebrating the mercy of God who passed over the Hebrews' homes as the angel of death went out and slaughtered all firstborn males of those homes which did not have the blood of the covenant on the doorpost. Yom Kippur, which is the new year, and Hanukkah, which celebrates the Maccabean victory over the Seleucids. While Christians and Muslims will stress different ethical values as well as different religious holidays, Sunday as opposed to Saturday, or Sabbath, Easter, Christmas for Christians, Friday, Sabbath, and Ramadan for Muslims, and so forth, they do agree that the ethical laws given to Moses on Mount Sinai were from God and are to be obeyed and thus follow their Jewish friends in stressing the fact that God is the foundation for moral values. And then finally, the afterlife. Jews have, at least since the time of the post-exilic prophets, affirmed the reality of a future personal immortality. All humans will live forever. In fact, the righteous, at least, will experience an actual resurrection of the body. The very body that went into the ground is the very body that will rise. The righteous will arise unto eternal bliss. Christians and Muslims have adopted this belief in a future resurrection of the just unto eternal life. Of course, most Abrahamic theists also believe that while the righteous will be raised into everlasting bliss, the unrighteous will suffer for eternity in hell. Okay, so questions about these core beliefs. These are what all Jews, Christians, and Muslims have in common.
At least devout Jews, Muslims,
and Christians. Right, but this is what the tradition says. You might have people that attend the synagogue, the church, and all that, but I can't really speak for them.
Sure.
Why would you want to go to these places if you don't believe what they believe? All right, so evaluation. There are more than a few contributions that monotheists have given to the world. These are Abrahamic theists. And whenever I say theists from this point forward, I mean Abrahamic theists. I don't mean anything else than that. First, theists offer the world a truly comprehensive view of reality. Theism offers an explanation of the universe, humanity's place in it, a source for knowledge and ethical values, and personal immortality for human beings. Second, notice that the theist is able to avoid the pitfalls of both polytheism and pantheism. The polytheist gives us a personal God, to be sure, but such a God is not infinite, and hence is simply not comprehensive enough. The pantheist gives us an infinite God, but such a deity is not personal, and hence is a being with whom humans simply cannot have a personal relationship. Theists avoid the pitfalls of pantheism by affirming God's personality, and they avoid the pitfalls of polytheism by affirming his infinitude. Third, it almost goes without saying that the God of theism has comforted the souls of countless millions. In times of stress, people have sought this God in prayer, and they have felt an inner peace as a result. If such a God does exist, the theist has a right to his comfort. For God, who is good, wants to hear the prayers of his followers. A God who is personal and all-knowing is able to hear such prayers. And he who is all-powerful is able to help in times of need. Fourth, the doctrine of Imago Dei is an especially important contribution to culture. The belief that all persons have innate dignity and value, at least historically, has been embraced by countless millions in the West because of the conviction that we're all made in the image of God. While theists are not so naive as to think that all of our differences will be resolved by simply accepting this doctrine, there is some truth to the conviction that unless the human race accepts the notion that everyone matters, that everyone is worthy to be treated with dignity and respect, there is no basis for believing in universal human rights. The doctrine of the Imago Dei, if true, provides us with a reason to embrace such a belief. Fifth, more than a few theists have contributed to the improvement of human learning and flourishing in human culture. For example, algebra and the Arabic numbering system came to us through the Muslim thinkers of the Middle Ages. Important insights into the various dimensions of philosophy were given to us by Averroes, Maimonides, Aquinas, and others. Some of the greatest stories and epics have been inspired by the Judeo-Christian Islamic worldviews. The 1001 Arabian Nights, the Chronicles of Narnia, the Lord of the Rings. Modern science was born in the Christian West, and many of the West's founders of science were motivated by their belief in God. Copernicus, Francis Bacon, Galileo, Tycho Brahe, Newton, Pasteur, Faraday, Calvin, Lemaître, the list goes on. And finally, few will deny that no other book in history has made the impact on human culture that the Bible has. Geisler and Nix point out the following. No book has been more widely disseminated and has more broadly influenced the course of world events than the Bible. The Bible has been translated into more languages, been published in more copies, influenced more thought, inspired more art, and motivated more discoveries than any other book in history. The Bible has been translated into over 1,000 languages, representing more than 90% of the world's population. It has been published in billions of copies. There are no close seconds to it on the all-time bestseller list. The influence of the Bible and its teaching in the Western world is clear for all who study history. And the influential role of the West in the course of world events is equally clear. Civilization has been influenced more by the Judeo-Christian scriptures than by any other book or series of books in the world. Indeed, no great moral or religious work in the world exceeds the depth or morality in the principle of Judeo-Christian love, and none has a more lofty spiritual concept than the biblical view of God. The Bible presents the highest ideals known to men, ideals that have molded civilization. None of this, of course, proves that God exists, much less that the Bible is inspired by God. Indeed, more than a few atheists will disagree with the morality of the Bible. That said, the reader should appreciate the fact that the Abrahamic theists, along with the Bible, have made more than a few positive contributions to humanity. So before we go do the internal critique, any other contributions that you can think of?
Well covered.
Okay. All right. So here we are. The core doctrines of the theistic system, are they true? Does the God of Abraham exist? A minute ago, I told you that there were two expressions or two kinds of expressions of Abrahamic theism. One expression is religious, and I already told you what that is: Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. The other expression is philosophical. And it turns out that there are three philosophical views of God, or three different kinds of philosophical theism. And you can find these expressions in all the religions. The modern world has names for these, or at least I have my own nomenclature for these, and some people you'll see following it and others not, but here's my nomenclature, or here are my labels. The first view of God is classical theism. The second view is neoclassical theism. And the third is open view theism. The classical theist believes that God transcends time, is absolutely simple, sees all things going on at a glance, all temporal moments going on at a glance, is all powerful and knowing all good, has predetermined the entire future, and so forth. That's classical theism. Neoclassical theism sort of waffles between open view theism and classical theism. Some people refer to this as theistic personalism. And when they do that, they're probably bringing the open view of God into this, so creating a larger matrix, if you will. Does that make sense to you? In other words, the neoclassical theist wants to change some things about the classical view of God because he's impressed with some of the criticisms given to that God by the open view theists, and for that matter, by atheists or whatever. So neoclassical theists will say something like this. There are some things that are just not feasible for God to do. There's some worlds that he can't make. The neoclassical theists will say things like, after creating the universe, God entered into time, so he is temporal and therefore intrinsically changing. The neoclassical theists will say things like, I think I've said a lot there with those. They'll deny the simplicity of God. They'll say that maybe God has contingent attributes.
Contingent upon
us. They're contingent upon sort of the world he creates. So if God had created a different kind of world, he might have a different set of attributes. Okay, so they would say those things about God. The open view theists will take those ideas of the neoclassicists and just take them further. The open view theists will say that God created the universe out of nothing but is now temporal. God is intrinsically changing. There's real give and take between him and the creation. God doesn't know the future exhaustively because he is in time. And since he is in time, the only thing he can know is the present. Does that mean that God is not omniscient? No, says the open theist. He's omniscient because he knows all that is. And all that is the present and the past. So he knows all that is happening, and he knows all that has happened, but the future doesn't exist yet. And since the future doesn't exist yet, there's literally nothing for him to know.
They can do that because they put God in time.
Yeah, and if God is in time,
he's not in time,
you can say that.
I can't argue that.
If omniscient is the knowledge of all truths, and if only present tense propositions and past tense propositions can describe what is true, the future tense propositions are neither true nor false, says the open view theist.
So they say,
and therefore God doesn't know the future.
And our ability to predict the future is what?
That's all speculation. It's not, we don't have the ability to predict the future. We can speculate about it.
So then is all science speculation?
No, because there's some future events that follow necessarily from the present, like the rising of the sun tomorrow. And God can know those things, but he's talking about contingent future events, like who's going to win the World Series 20 years from now.
Well,
I mean, I'm not asking you to accept any one of these views of God. I'm simply asking.
I'm just trying to ask so I understand it and pick at it a little bit.
Sure.
But I guess if you're going to say that, yeah. Well, anyways, continue.
Just appreciate the fact that there are three philosophical expressions of theism. So it's not enough to just say, "Well, I reject Abrahamic theism." Which version? Because some arguments you give against one may not apply to the other. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
All right. Internal critique. We finally come to the internal critique. And we have 10 minutes. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to introduce you to sort of the presuppositions going into the debate, and then tomorrow we'll pick up on page 174. So this last little bit here is what we'll read, and then we'll end here. The all-important question is this: does God exist, or does the God of Abraham exist?
Bless you.
Excuse me. It would seem that all the core doctrines of the theistic system stand or fall with this issue. Indeed, if one were able to show that an infinite personal God has caused the world to be, then one has, for all practical purposes, shown that a deity, much like the one described in the Abrahamic religions, exists. Establishing the existence of such a deity would automatically render the common elements among theists plausible, if not probably true. Conversely, if one were to show that God doesn't exist or probably doesn't exist or whatever, we will automatically have shown that the other doctrines of theism are false. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
There are a number of interesting and even persuasive reasons non-theists have offered for the theists that God probably does not exist. However, before we turn to those reasons, it is imperative that we offer two basic presuppositions many Western non-theists have embraced, which play a very important, though not necessary, role in establishing their thesis. First, the burden of proof is on the theist to prove God's existence. It is not upon the atheist to prove God's non-existence. Many thinking people of our day insist that this is just common sense, for it is the one who makes a positive assertion about the world who bears the burden to prove the proposition in question. Let me give you an example, just this not written down here. Mormons come knocking on your door. They come into your home, and they tell you that you need to convert to their religion. Who bears the burden of proof in that discussion?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you were minding your own business. You weren't bothering them. You see, the person who comes up and says, you got to do this, that, or the other, is they that has the burden to prove that you got to do this, that, or the other.
Mm-hmm.
So when a person is at a party and someone goes, prove to me that your God exists. You say somebody's preaching, you know, at a party. They're like telling everybody what to believe. Oh, you got to repent, blah, blah, blah. So somebody walks up and says, prove to me that your God exists. And then they go, well, prove to me that God doesn't exist. That's not a refutation of the atheist or the non-theist in general, because the non-theist was just minding his own business. He's walking across campus and there's this dude in the quad preaching to him. And then he just asks, well, what evidence do you have that this God exists? What evidence do you have that he doesn't? That's not a good response, because the non-theist wasn't standing in the quad making all of these assertions.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's the person who makes the assertion that has the burden of proof. Atheists don't believe that God doesn't exist. They simply don't believe that there's a God. Presumably, if you give them evidence, they will believe that there's a God. So Bart Ehrman goes, is there a God? He goes, how the hell should I know? And then he goes, but I guess I have to say I'm an atheist, not just an agnostic, right? I'm an agnostic atheist because not only do I think that there's no way of knowing such a thing, at least for me, I don't know, but I also don't believe that there is such a being as God. So who bears the burden of proof? The atheist is not claiming anything about the world. You are. And since you were making this claim that this infinite personal being exists, you have the burden of proof. To use Bertrand Russell's famous illustration as an example, another example, imagine that someone came to you and said, there's a teapot orbiting our sun, which unfortunately cannot be detected by our telescopes. Who has the burden to prove his position? Well, is it the man who says that he does not believe in such a teapot? Well, surely he doesn't have the burden to prove it. He just was walking along and you say, hey, you know, there's a teapot going around the sun and our telescopes can't detect it. Great. What's your evidence of that? What's your evidence that it doesn't exist? To ask the question, of course, along these lines is to answer the question. In the same way, when the theist says there's an all-powerful, all-knowing, and all-good creator of the universe, it is surely his burden to prove the existence of such a deity. To expect the atheist to have any burden to prove the purported deity's non-existence is irrational. A second presupposition non-theists insist upon is what is often called methodological naturalism. That is to say, the proper method used to discover explanations for natural phenomena is to prefer natural explanations over and against supernatural explanations. Why? Because we know the universe is real, but we do not know that God is real. Indeed, the burden of proof, remember, is on the theist to prove there's a God. So until one has such a proof of a deity, one should look for natural explanations for natural phenomena. Another reason to embrace methodological naturalism is the history of science. Time and again, theists have offered supernatural explanations for things like how can we explain the origin of life, of species, of visions, of dreams, of demons, of spirits, and so forth. And time and again, science has progressively discovered a perfectly good and natural explanation for these things, abiogenesis, Darwinian evolution, psychosomatic illness, and so forth. Does not the success of science over the past 500 years force us to assume that unless there are compelling reasons for the contrary or to the contrary, when we encounter a mysterious X, it is understandable as a purely natural phenomenon? Now, some may think that by embracing methodological naturalism and placing the burden of proof squarely on the shoulders of the theist, non-theists are stacking the deck against the theist in such a way that theism becomes virtually impossible. In other words, if the theist follows the atheist rules, theism loses by default. But the non-theistic counter-response seems fair. Indeed, methodological naturalism does not entail metaphysical naturalism. For if God does exist, and if God wants us to know the truth, then surely one is able, at least in principle, to rule out all possible natural explanations of an event or phenomenon and show that, therefore, God did it. And courts of law often witness affirmers winning over the non-committed. You go to court, someone says, he did it. And the court says, you have the burden of proof. Does the person with the burden of proof always lose in a court trial? No, they meet the burden. They give the evidence. And that's what the non-theist expects the theist to do. Why can't the theist meet his own burden? It is not impossible for the non-theist to have their open mind. It is not impossible for the non-theist to have an open mind about the existence of God. All the theist needs to do is supply the non-theist with persuasive evidence for his worldview. So, does God exist? Non-theists generally offer the following lines of evidence to show that God does not exist. A, there are no good reasons to think that the theistic God exists. B, theism is incoherent. And C, the proposition God does not exist can be inferred via several inductively strong arguments, meaning that theism is highly improbable. We don't have time to get into these today, but tomorrow we will start by looking at the purported arguments for God's existence and see if the theist can meet his burden of proof.